This is a short story called Dead Sonnet. Diana wakes to find she's being fucked from behind. He moves against her in tiny thrusts. His breathing is quick, shallow, stifled, a caged mammal on the edge of reason. She lies quite still, facing the window. There's a long, slim gap through the cream tab-top curtains, $12.99 from Homemaker DIY, through which she traces a vertical slice of the world, a sliver of blue sky, the ridged roof of the garden shed, a stray branch, its leaves glossy with overnight rain. She tilts her head into the pillow a fraction until sunlight sparks from the water droplets. The curtain edges flicker as he comes. His breath quickens and a little moan escapes his mouth, drifting over her shoulder in a waft of stale beer. She shuts her eyes. When she opens them again, her gaze falls off the side of the window and lands on the chest of drawers. $69.99 from the catalogue. She can't remember which, but a payment is due. There's a red bill hiding somewhere under a pile of papers. The two little drawers at the top are lolling open, clinging to the frame like fingers on a mountain ridge. Socks, black, green, and grey-white, where they got mixed in with the wrong wash, are bulging over the top. His prick is shrinking away, like a mollusk withdrawing into its shell. From where she lies with her back to him, she can't picture him, but she imagines instead some kind of geloid alien with slimy flesh. When she was 17, he was Mark Antony to her Cleopatra. Strange now to think that she saw in that tale only the helpless romance of unorthodox lovers, the two of them alone against the world. Even the bitter ending seemed poetic. On top of the pine chest, the ironing pile Mum did 2 weeks ago is stacked 40, 50 items high. The edges of white school shirts folded to precision alternate with pairs of jeans and navy sweatshirts. As the pile tapers towards the ceiling, it bends to the right. One heavy footstep on the wrong floorboard will send it toppling to the floor. Her torso dips into the mattress as he swings his legs over the side of the bed. She slides her left knee over the right. Fluid trickles down her thighs, and a million spermatozoa, each with the whisper of new life locked up in its secret code, spill onto the sheet, where they will wither and die. She wonders what any one of them would have created had it fused with her cell, male or female, blonde or dark, blue-eyed or brown. It's strange how she hasn't got pregnant again since the twins. Not that she craves a child anymore, but she wonders if the mechanisms have become faulty. Maybe the barrenness in her heart has blown over her insides like an encroaching desert. She listens to him dress on the edge of the bed. With each inflection of the mattress, she recognises the order of his clothes. Jeans, socks, T-shirt, sweater, arms first, then head straining through the turtleneck. The bed springs uncoil as he stands. She closes her eyes until the door clicks shut and his boots clatter on the bottom steps. She glances at the blue plastic bedside clock. $6.99 from Saver Store. The twins have to be up for school in 10 minutes. She watches a slim black finger tick round the dots and thinks, when it's vertical, she'll get up. She can hear his breakfast routine, the clink of crockery, the muffled voice of the radio DJ, his footsteps on the lino. Every sound has its place, its time, its rhythm, a worn-out, overplayed symphony. If she pulls back the duvet, the morning will unfold of its own accord, but she can't move. There's a short circuit in the nerve channels where the message should pass from brain to limb to muscle. She lies still, observing the tattered edges of the wallpaper where it meets the window frame. She hadn't noticed it peeling until she saw Mum looking at it as she placed the ironing on top of the chest. Mum didn't say anything, but her face tightened, and later that day she gave her a check and said, "Buy yourself something nice for the house. Go on, take it. It's an early birthday present." Mum has kept her room at home as it was the day she left, a teenage den covered in posters, the wardrobe doors bulging with the force of too many clothes, the shelves bowed with books, Shakespeare and Germain Greer, Wordsworth and Wollstonecraft. It's a shrine to the daughter she should have been if she hadn't got herself into trouble. Mum vacuums the carpet regularly and dusts the dressing table, lifting each perfume bottle and replacing it in its exact spot. Julia pictures her, yellow duster in hand, scrubbing each surface until it's scrupulously clean, the same way she scours personalities of defects. He should be leaving, but there's footsteps climbing the stairs. By the door, the oval mirror on the oak dressing table, 20 quid from the junk shop on Canterbury Road, shivers with each step. The bedroom door is flung open. Her eyes dart to the ironing pile. He approaches the bed. He places a mug of tea on the bedside table. He stands over her, feet apart, like a colossus, Mark Antony in steel toe caps. "Are you getting up?" His voice is a sledgehammer on a brick wall. This is how crap a wife she's become. Even despunking doesn't quell his anger anymore. She must get up. She can take that voice as it is, but if he showed her any tenderness, if he brushed her face with his fingers, the tears would come and wouldn't stop. She pulls back the duvet. She swings her legs over the side of the bed and sits for a moment. He's so close she can smell his breath again, mint toothpaste attempting to mask strong tea. "For Christ's sakes," he shouts. "Are you going to sit there all day?" Her hands clench. Her fists sink into the mattress. She will not cry. She won't give him the satisfaction. "The kids will be late again. And look at the state of this place. This room's a shithole." She lifts her chin. "Suitable for pigs," she says. She holds his gaze. And he leaps in front of her suddenly, punching the air in some bizarre shadow boxing feint. Then he's gone. The door slams. Her eye catches a flicker of movement. The ironing pile is toppling over in slow motion, the demolition of a tower block. White shirts flutter through the air, unfolding as they fall, and land crumpled beside the pine chest. She pulls on tracksuit bottoms and a zip-up sweatshirt. She stands in front of the mirror and scrapes her hair into a red scrunchie, licks her finger and runs it under each eye, smearing away the soot granules of yesterday's makeup. She wakes the twins and goes down to the kitchen, picks two cereal bowls, $1.99 each from the supermarket, special offer, from the cold grey water in the sink and rinses them under the tap. There are 1,000 reasons to leave, she thinks, tipping rice pots into the bowls, and only one to stay. There's a photo on the kitchen worktop, him with the girls, a daughter balanced on each knee, smiling, ringlets tumbling. That's how she must have looked, snuggled up to her own dad, before he left. "Must be something in my genes," she says aloud, startling herself. "There must be some chromosomal defect passed down through the females that erodes the love of a man. Because he did love her once. He had thick black curls and olive skin. He wore a battered leather jacket and drove a motorbike. Mum had forbidden her to ride pillion, so he'd drop her at the bus stop at the end of the road and she'd walk the last few hundred yards to the front door as slowly as she could so her face could recover from the wind blast. She liked ocean colour scene and Shakespeare. She had a place at Keele University to read English. She remembers A-level classes, Antony and Cleopatra open on the desk, Mrs. Hedrich's voice droning, and she, with her head in her hands, eyes closed, her mind replaying endlessly the violin adagio of his skin on hers. She thought she was so original, but this is what she fell in love with, a teenage cliche. She stands by the dining table, tipping milk into breakfast bowls, thinking, it is a fact, this grand passion we had. It's part of our mythology, but no matter how hard she tries, she can't reconjure the emotion. The pictures are stored in her mind, but they're black and white, flat and lifeless, a dead sonnet. By the time she drops the children at school, she's also late. She'll have to go back home to dress for the office. As she draws up to the traffic light at the crossroads, a sign catches her eye. It's a piece of laminated paper stuck to a telegraph pole with a red drawing pin. There's an 0800 number and a logo for Kent Women's Aid. "Are you a victim of sexual abuse?" it reads. Her heart, her brain, her breathing, everything stops. For a second, it's as if she's poised on the edge of death. She turns her eyes away, left, right, anywhere but the sign, but they're drawn back again. She stares at the words sexual and abuse, trying to find some meaning in them. There's another sign above it. "Need cash for Christmas?" it reads. "Earn up to £300 a month delivering catalogues in your area." She thinks suddenly of beautiful dolls wrapped in gold paper, one for each of the girls. She reaches for her mobile and starts to punch in the number with trembling fingers. A car horn blares. In her rearview mirror, a man in shirt sleeves is mouthing obscenities at her. The light is green. She's dropped the mobile on the floor and it's disappeared under her seat. The horn blares out again. Swanky white shirt man is poking the air in front of his windscreen. She engages first gear, lifts her foot from the clutch, but as the car inches away from the lights, she swerves suddenly to the right. There's a white car hurtling towards her, but she jams her foot down hard on the gas and points the bonnet towards the coast road. There's a screech of tyres behind her. Another horn, longer, angrier. In the mirror, she glimpses Swanky Man. He's sitting in the middle of the junction, waving his arm through the window and screaming. Hot tears are streaming down her cheeks and the road ahead is a blur. A picture flashes through her mind. She's leaping onto Swanky Man's bonnet, pulling down her pants and flashing her bare ass through his window. Within an hour, she's walking on wet sand, her fake fur collar turned up against the icy wind. The beach is deserted. She turns and walks with her back into the breeze, her trousers pinned to the backs of her knees. She watches as her footprints are swallowed in a slick of water and sand. The sea is slate grey and angry. A pair of gulls wheel overhead. Their beaks are open, but their screeches are an unsynchronised soundtrack, the noise caught up on the ocean wind and replayed in stereo somewhere far behind. She follows the birds as they float and dip and dive. When her fingers are raw, she heads to a glass-fronted cafe on the prom. The air inside smells of calagas. She sits at a formica top table and reads the menu. She looks up to see the waiter standing beside her and orders a cappuccino and a ham sandwich. He has a blue and red butterfly tattoo on the back of his right hand. He's in his 30s, long, bleached hair, blue eyes, stud earring, the type of man her husband would call a fucking queer. "Reckon you'll need that coffee to warm you up." His voice has the rising intonation of an Australian. "Yeah, it's freezing out there," she says. "Too cold even for me," he laughs. "No surfing today." She watches his back disappear through the bead curtain. "A beach bum, a skiver," Mum would say. "At least your Chris brings in the money, even if he is only a builder." Then she remembers the cheque in her purse. She needs a lamp for the twins' bedroom. She'll look round the cheap second-hand shops on the cobbled old town streets after lunch. Chris wouldn't approve. He hates second-hand stuff. "What are we, poor?" he would say. She used to buy all her clothes second-hand before she met him. She loved browsing through flea markets, feeling the weight of old silks, taffetas and velvets. She even loved the smell of musty fabric and mothballs. After she met him, she stopped. He preferred her in miniskirts. The coffee is thin and watery, but hot. She wraps both hands around the cup and takes little pecking sips. She looks out at the white crests of water. A few bedraggled raindrops spatter the window. "Day off," the waiter says, handing her the sandwich on a white plate. "Sort of," she says. "Thought I'd do some browsing in the antique shops." "You'd be right, there's some great bargains." He leans against the wall and folds his arms over his chest. He tells her about the furniture he bought for his flat over the top of the games arcade on the high street. When he's animated, his hands flutter in front of him without him noticing. "I love old stuff," he says. "I like the serendipity of finding something individual, something that's been crafted." "Serendipity," she says, "good word. But it implies chance is a good thing." "Isn't it?" he says, smiling. When he brings her change, she's trying to remember something about chance, something she read years ago about the kitten being gassed in a cardboard box, and she wants to ask him if he can fill in the gaps, but maybe that would make her sound pompous. "Listen," he says, I finish in 20 minutes. I'll show you that like shop if you like. She feels heat rising in her cheeks. She picks up the loose change, the loose coins of her change. Thanks, but I have to get back, she says. School run. As she stands, the chair clutters to the floor. Oh, sorry. No worries, he says. He picks up the chair and passes her jacket. She rushes to the door. Behind her, she thinks she hears him say, enjoy your afternoon. She heads for the high street and finds the lighting shop. The window is festooned with light bulbs winking from crystal chandeliers and table lamps. Her eyes jitter over the black figurines, the raffia bells, the stained glass mosaics of dragonflies and amaryllis. She tries to differentiate one lamp from another, but the lights slur into one. It will be warm in there, she thinks. And a flush of blood rises in her chest, prickles across her shoulder blades and down the length of her arms. The opening of a thousand rosebuds, she thinks aloud. That's what his hands would have felt like. Her reflection surfaces in the glass. Her hair is tatty and windblown, streaming out of its ponytail like seaweed in the current. Chris hates it when her hair is a mess. She raises her hand to pull out the scrunchie, but something about seeing herself do this in the shop window makes her stop. She locks her fingers together and slides her hands behind her head, jutting her elbows out beyond her shoulders. She's staring at someone else, a stranger. Your husband is a rapist, she says to the face in the window. She says it again, rolling the word around her tongue, rapist. For the first time, she realises the word is onomatopoeic, the first syllable describing the thud of something solid on soft, unyielding flesh. The second syllable is the hiss of an audience at the pantomime villain. When she was 17, there was no law against a man raping his wife. But back then, she wasn't his wife, and he didn't rape her. She tries to think back to the first time. She can't remember a date or even a year. She can only remember the thump of two solid flesh, the way the curtains seem to shiver like props in some Greek tragedy, the overwhelming sadness when he pulled out of her that it had come to this, that if there was to be a future, they would both have to pretend it hadn't happened. She stares at the shop window, her focus shifting between the light display and her own ghost. The wind flutters over her jacket, ruffling the grey fur fringe around her face, tickling her chin. She is mouthing words to the face in the window. It's not the physical violation that matters, she says. It's the way he's raped you over the years of your personality. After a while, in the window, she sees another reflection behind her own, a tall figure walking towards her. She should leave, she should turn and go, but her feet won't move. Prickles of fear spread over her back, up her neck, into her head, where they burst like the death of a supernova.